begin with a bow to each other. So in the bow, imagine that you're scooping everything of life. War, famine, things you don't like in politics, things you don't like in your relationship, things you don't like about yourself, the beauty of the world, the beauty of that beautiful river today, the meadows, the colors, the rain, the things you love about yourself and of life. Let's equally gather them to our heart. So really this sense of gathering with so much equanimity. So we gather it to our heart, and traditionally, as this was taught, that we would hold the space of that at our heart with the opening as if we were holding a lotus within our palms so that it could grow through our middle fingers. We don't have to be that detailed about it, but that's how mindful it is in the sense of holding the lotus that grows in the muck, this beautiful flower that grows out of the muck. We hold it to our heart. And then we just hold this poignant moment with each other, whether your hands are at your heart or they're in Anjali. This sense of just holding this poignancy with each other. And whoever is Umze, which would be me because I am ringing the bell today, if Peter is ringing the bell, he is Umze, that's the person who leads the bow. And we bow with the top of our head, which is a sense of humility. But we hold the sense of poignancy for just a moment together in the space, in this sense of presence with one another and with ourselves or Buddha nature, with the space. And then we bow. So I offer that as the way that we would bow after every gong, that sense of that kind of mindfulness and that kind of presence to one another and to ourselves and to Buddha nature. So why do we come on retreat? So I'd love to just hear just a few responses from people. Why do you come on retreat?
To recharge.
Okay.
For silence.
Silence.
For healing.
Okay.
To learn.
So we come on retreat to clarify, to recharge, to find silence, stillness. We come to retreat to step out of our day-to-day busyness, and we come on retreat to be held in this way that is rare in our normal lives, where everything is taken care of for us. Our food is being cooked. There's nothing that we have to do except for just be here. To be here with our sensations, with our moods, with our patterns, with our resistances, with our heart, with our joy or our pain, with all of life. That's all we have to do here, is to keep showing up and using the support that is here. And there's so much support. The support that we have in the refuge, the three jewels that we took this morning, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the precepts that we took this morning, the place, the container of the retreat, the silence, the gongs, the schedule, the meals, the yogi jobs, and two primary things, which is the natural world and our practice. And I'm going to talk about the natural world and using it as a support, and also then our practice after that. But this is so rare to be taken care of like this, where it's so set up for you to be able to commit to your practice. We're such control freaks, most of us. I'll speak for myself. And it's very hard to let myself be taken care of completely and to let go in some way into a container. There's a feeling of like needing to do something. And there's a way that our brains are set up to solve problems. That's their primary design. And they're fabulous at it. And if you notice that if there isn't a problem, it will create a problem so it can solve it. And the mind will be looking for that all day long, is to find a problem. And that's one of the things about coming on retreat, is that there really is actually very little problem here. Things are pretty easy, pretty taken care of for us. The only thing that there is the problem is our own mind and how we relate to it. So I'll come back to that. But I want to talk about nature and why nature is such an incredible support for us. So why do you want to be in nature? I ask that. Why do you want to be in nature? Just a few words.
Calming.
Calming.
Pure.
Pure. Perfect order.
Connected.
Connected. I think that for many, and from what I'm hearing here too, is that if I was to translate that, it's also, it's this portal into experiencing the sacred, into something that is mystical and that is bigger than us, that helps us create a sense of this connectedness, this calm, this perfect order. We get to see life in that perfect perfection. And nature is not perfect. Things die, things decay, things are blown up by rock slides and lightning and avalanches and floods but in its own self, there's perfect order to that. When we go into nature, we tune into something that is this, it's naturally delightful. I mean, look at what she comes up with. I mean, it's absolutely awe-inspiring. And she has no second thought about it. It's just this creation. It's infinite creativity constantly. And when we're out in that, there's a sense of delight that we can touch into. It brings us out of ourselves into this sense of presence when we let it. And because of that presence, it's very, very helpful for our practice, very supportive for our practice. Often when we sit inside in a retreat hall and we're primarily with our mind and our body, it can be a little effortful, a little strained, there can be a little struggle to it. And as there can be outside, but it tends to be easier outside. We can get in touch with a more sort of graceful ease, a more graceful presence. And because of that, there's so much, we can tap into something. We don't have to struggle. We can actually use our senses and that delight and that awe to help us actually really arrive. Without this presence, that we get when we practice, but that's easier in nature often, we can't penetrate into the truth. So try seeing the truth when you're stressed out, you're late for work, you're driving in traffic, and you're rushing. Try seeing the truth of things. It's often very difficult. So when we're in nature and there's a sense of ease, there's a way that we can touch this sense of presence and then this essence of truth, being with things as they are, seeing the truth of the nature of things, which I'll explain more as we go. So in nature, there's less selfing, right? Less sense of self or sense of other, right? The trees out there are not going, wow, I am really, really a lot better than that other tree. Or another tree saying, God, I am so much fatter. I'm so fat today. I can't believe how fat I am today. The trees and animals don't do that. There's no selfing out there. They are just fully, completely tree. They are fully, completely squirrel. Fully, completely river. And they aren't hoping or wanting to be other than who they are. The way our minds are designed is that the egoic mind is set up to be comparing. I like you, I don't like you, you're better than me, you're bigger than me, you're taller, you're shorter, you're smarter, you're whatever. We're constantly, if you go into a grocery store, unknowingly, unconsciously, everything we see, we're tracking, where do we rate, right? But when we go out in nature and that's happening less, that's just not happening out there, there's a way that we can begin to let go of our sense of ourselves, our sense of I. We can relax into this so much when we're just with things being what they are. And when we do that, we soften that habit, that habitual patterning of the comparing mind. And when we do that, this defended posture begins to quiet some, and we can actually become happier. We're a lot happier when we think about ourselves less. A sense of boundary starts to collapse, which allows this sense of, again, more ease, less defendedness, which allows our hearts to open and to feel more of our natural state, which is love. It also allows us to feel our pain and our longing and our loneliness, whatever might be there for us, our joy, our awe, all of which, if we actually were to really, really be with, we would enter back into a place of love. Our hearts can break open when there's that amount of ease, when we're so not so lost in ourselves, when we're more intimate with life just as it is. We need joy and delight and happiness in our lives. We work really, really hard to be happy. And we work really hard in all the wrong ways, because usually the way we work to be happy doesn't usually bring a lot of happiness. But if you might have already noticed in your life and your relationship to the natural world, there's something that happens that is just an inherent happiness that can come when we're in beauty, in nature, in thunder. Nature heals and inspires our hearts. We'll be really looking at that later on in the retreat when we're working more with emotions. Peter was talking about this sense of receiving through our senses today. Receiving sound, receiving sight, not going out and grabbing at things, not going out and trying to solidify something. That's one of the reasons why we were suggesting that you don't take pictures this week, is that there's a sense of wanting to go out and capture something, to hold it, to solidify it. Have you noticed that when you see something beautiful, sometimes when you're by yourself, we can sometimes go to a place of like, oh, I have to tell this person about it. Right? I just have to tell them about it. I wish they were here. I want to tell them about it. I need to get a picture so I can they can be here with me. And there's a way in which we want to capture it, retell it, be with it again, instead of just letting this moment, this effect of that beauty move us and then pass. And now we're here for the next thing that arises. And that moves us. And then it passes. The Buddha practiced, when he gave up his strict ascetic practices, which were, he practiced outside, but he really realized that there was an ease that he felt in the natural world that helped cultivate his presence and helped him understand and see the truth, to see the Dharma. The night of his awakening, his enlightenment, he was being challenged and tormented by Mara. Mara was coming to him to come and try to tempt him out of this awakening. All the things that might tempt him away, his passions and aggressions and desires and fantasies and putting everything in his mind that he possibly could have that he might want to take. But the Buddha just kept sitting and staying with what was true. But the final thing Mara did was to say, "Who do you think you are to think that you could wake up?" And in that moment, the Buddha reached down and touched the earth and said, "The earth is my witness." That connection with the earth was so strong that he knew that he could use the earth to be there to hold him steady in that and to see him as he held steady against, knowing that he too could wake up, that we too can wake up. And this waking up when we're in nature is so, it's so clear. The teachings or the truth. What is the truth? What do we see when we're with things as they are? We see impermanence. That life is constantly changing. The clouds are never static. The colors are changing. The river is going downstream. That everything is in a chain, is in a constant state of dying, being reborn, growing, changing, decaying. Everything is in a state of flux. And when we're in nature, more than anywhere else, we see that so clearly. We see this sense of no separation, that things are not separating themselves from anything else. They are being what they are in absolute total connection with everything else, totally dependent on everything else. Codependent on everything else, the sun, the earth, the way the soil is, the way the other plants are to it, how much water there is, where it is in relationship to the wind. That we get to see that death is part of the natural cycle. That there are these cycles in life, that there is the cycle of the moon, the cycle of the sun, the cycle of the seasons, cycle of the day and night. So we say that the place or nature is the teacher, because we get to see, we get to actually be in what is true. So we let the simplest things, the sun on our face, the sound of a bug, the sound of the river, a cloud moving across the sky, we let all those things move us and soothe us, ground us. When you see the cloud move across the sky, let it help you remember that that is the nature of your thoughts. The thought is just moving, it just moves in, and if you let it, it moves out. If you go and grab it, it will stay. But if you actually just notice the thought arising, and the thought passing, and you remember a cloud in the sky. It just is passing through. Piece of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So how do we come onto retreat and use all this support? The first thing is to really to commit to being here. For many, many years, I would go on retreat, and I would kind of keep one foot out the door. Kind of, I would be here, but there was a way in which I felt like if I kind of had a part of me kind of out, where I was still having to make decisions and still I was sort of judging things and judging the retreat and in that kind of comparing mode and thinking about my life, that there was a way that I felt like I didn't have to fully surrender, because I didn't really want to completely surrender. It actually felt a little scary to me. I don't know if anybody else ever has that experience. But there's a way that I realized over time that it was such a loss to actually keep myself out of the retreat completely. So how do we actually commit to being here? One, this is actually a very short period of time, this retreat. It's this unbelievable gift. I can't tell you how many retreats that I have been on that throughout the whole retreat I said to myself, I will never do this again, I will never do this again, I will never do this again, I will never do this again. And it was about the only way I could get through the retreat. Like saying, I will never do this again. And then after retreat saying, I can't wait for the next retreat, I can't wait for the next retreat. I'm going to sign up today for the next retreat. So kind of welcome to retreat. That's kind of how we do it. But there's a sense of like, that resistance, you know, we kind of resist the schedule and resist having to get up and resist the, you know, like, well, I just want to read, you know, friggin' novel out here. And all the ways we might want to kind of escape. But this is a very short period of time. And because we've done this for so long, and for so many people who have led retreats and know what supports the retreat practitioner the most, we're not trying to torture you. That there actually is a method to the madness. That if you can commit, and I'll be saying more about what we're committing to in a moment, but this sense of even the resistance, if you can stay present to the resistance, that's the gateway. So when there's a poem by Hema that says, to stay with that shakiness, to stay with a broken heart, with a rumbling stomach, with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge, that is the path of true awakening. Sticking with that uncertainty, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, learning to not panic, this is the spiritual path. Whatever you're given, you can wake up to, or it can put you to sleep. That's the challenge of now. What are you going to do with that? So it's this sense that everything that comes up is the gateway everything. We can sit here and say, oh, I'm having a really bad meditation. I don't like this meditation. I'm just all over the place. I'm thinking about everything else. I'm not even here. My back hurts. And if we actually are to enter into that experience, not the story about that, but that experience, that is the gateway. So we use everything. There is no good meditation and a bad meditation. It's all practice. It's all path. So, a couple little suggestions, and I'm going to circle back around to mindfulness. But don't fuss with your stuff. So you might find that you have your little thingies. We all have our little thingies, right, that we do, our little thingies. So you all probably already, right when I say that, you kind of go, oh, yeah, right, I know my little thingies. But watch your little thingies that you do. What are your little habits that you do throughout the day? And those are probably habits that you have at home. Perfect, brilliant strategies for getting away from yourself. Oftentimes on retreat, people will organize things. Or you might have a thing about always being in the hall first, or always in the hall last, or that you want to be in mealtime, in the line first, or whatever it might be. You might fuss with your stuff, or you might be fussing internally about something. Whatever your habits are, just see if you can shift it up a little bit. See if you can kind of shift things up. Maybe try things a little bit differently. The word preoccupied, already occupied. We are preoccupied so often, mostly with ourselves. And when we're occupied, preoccupied with ourselves, we're not very available for life around us and for these gateways for our practice, these portals. I want to keep reminding you that you might think it was kind of crazy, but you actually chose to be here. And you can totally, completely trust that. You're the right person in the right place at the right time. That mantra I say to myself many times a day, I'm the right person in the right place at the right time. That you can trust the inspiration that you had to come here. And so this is why we give you these little tips along the way about, like, just paying attention to where are we consumed with our story, our stuff, our habits. I often tell people on retreat, let yourself feel kind of dumb, right? Because our minds are so designed to problem solve that we're creating problems. If there isn't a problem, we're going to create one. And the thing is that there actually is nothing to figure out here. If you came with some great hope that you were going to leave here with some great decision made or some, you know, big life learning that's going to, you're going to have it all figured out by the time you leave, I can kind of guarantee that if you try to go about it from that standpoint, you're going to be in the same paradigm you arrived in. But if you don't try to figure it out, let the mystery happen. Let the practice happen. That life just tends to figure itself out. And that there's something about kind of feeling a little dumb. It doesn't mean actually really spacing out. It might feel that way at times, but it actually is just letting the mind rest more and coming much more into sensation and to the raw experience of things. And tomorrow we're going to be going more into the body, into the emotions, and how do we actually start to just be with experience. So stay in beginner's mind. Stay in a state of don't know. don't know. I don't know. Not solidifying, not trying to have things figured out, not trying to pin life down. See if you can give up trying to stand on solid ground, because there isn't any. Life is constantly changing. And the more we actually try to solidify things, we struggle. But this sense of just staying with this cycle and flow of existence, we stop resisting life doing what life does. It's a lot easier. So this sense of staying in this, in don't know mind. A poem by Rilke, which many of you probably know. Be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Anthony DeMello, who was a radical Christian, beautiful man, said, enlightenment is the absolute cooperation with the inevitable. Enlightenment is the absolute cooperation with the inevitable. We're not fighting life. We're cooperating with life as it is. St. John of the Cross said, in order to come upon that which I know not, I must go by way in which I know not. In order to come upon that which I know not, I must go by the way in which I know not. Meaning that if we try to go to knowing or to our life or to attending to everything from the same paradigm, which is trying to solve all the problems with our mind and fussing and worrying and trusting the mind instead of the truth, which is things as they are, that we will continue to see things that we've always seen, and nothing will change. And that is why we ask you to really commit to your practice, to really commit to mindfulness. Just even in that bow, that sense of that is so much mindfulness in coming into that poignant moment, that intimacy, that the mindfulness is our greatest support here. All day long, you're being given an opportunity to be mindful. Everything that is arising is an opportunity to be mindful. Not when it's just nice and pleasant and happy, but all throughout the day. Sometimes the most difficult emotions are the greatest portals for us to be mindful. Keep returning to right now and watch the part that says whatever is happening right now is wrong or not okay, and just to keep remembering that it's all practice. See what it's like to be here and to really switch over from your daily life to retreat life. Just feeling inside once again to recommit to it. Recommit to being here. Just these short few days that could be deeply, deeply transformative. There's some helpful things. In the Zen tradition, when we enter into a hall or any doorway, we always step through with the leg that is closest to the hinges. Whenever we enter into the meditation hall or leave the meditation hall, we face into the space and we bow. Just a gentle bow. Not a big, long, bow, but just a gentle nodding of our heads. These kinds of things bring a sense of presence and mindfulness and awareness all day long, all throughout our day. When I ring the gong, before I ring the gong, I always am wishing that whatever comes of our practice is for all beings. Right? So there's everything we do has this sense of mindfulness and presence. So you might take on things like when you're leaving and entering into the hall, you might just bow into the space, the sacredness of the space, the wisdom quality of the space, to our little boat that we're all on. We could learn to stop when the sun goes down and when the sun comes up. We could learn to listen to the wind. We could learn to notice that it's raining or snowing or hailing or calm. We could reconnect with the weather that is ourselves, and we could realize that it's sad. The sadder it is and the vaster it is, the more our hearts open. We can stop thinking that good practice is when it's smooth and calm and bad practice is when it's rough and dark. If we can hold it all in our hearts, then we can make a proper cup of tea. Pema. Children. So we have all this support, the retreat, the practice, the gongs, the schedule, your yogi jobs, the natural world, which is just huge, and mindfulness. May it all be held with a big, huge cup of kindness. We're all on a challenging journey called life. So be so gentle on yourselves, so gently coming back over and over and over again. So I think I'll stop there and just see if there's any questions that might be here. We'll just sit for a few minutes together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.